You are tuned in to The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel.
I took your little plan and I turned it on itself. Look what I did to this city with a few drums of gas and a couple of bullets. Hmm? You know what I noticed? Nobody panics when things go according to plan. Even if the plan is horrifying. If tomorrow I tell the press that, like, a gangbanger will get shot, or a truckload of soldiers will be blowing up, nobody panics. Because it's all part of the plan. But when I say that one little old mare will die, well, then everyone loses their minds. Introduce a little anarchy. Upset the established order, and everything becomes chaos.
Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses.
Cedric Muhammad.
Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces draw the same that burn crosses. Killing in the name of. Killing in the name of. Now you do what they told you. Now you do what they told you. Now you do what they told you.
Cedric Muhammad.
Now you do what they told you. 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 Now you do what they told you.
You are tuned into The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel.
Now you do what they told you. Now you do what they told you. Don't you die.
Tuned in to The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel. Cedric Muhammad.
Forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces draw the same that burn crosses. Killing in the name of.
Cedric Muhammad.
Killing in the name of.
Cedric Muhammad.
Do what they told you. Now you 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 do what they told you.
To The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel. Tuned in to The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel.
It's no secret that slavery was once a part of London's economy. At various sites along the Thames, goods produced by slaves would arrive by ship from around the globe to be unloaded at one of the many piers or wharfs that lined both banks. Beyond the waterfront, the areas that now comprise London's modern financial district were also key to the industry. In the streets around the Bank of England, ships and insurance used in the slave trade were sold and bought.
Here at 12 St. Michael's Alley, is the site of the Jamaica Coffee House. It's where slave owners came to advertise the sale of their slaves and to offer bounties for those who had escaped. It's one of the many sites dotted around the square mile of London that reminds us of the link the city has had with slavery and the profits that were made off its back.
And those links may soon become a bit clearer. University College London recently launched a new project titled The Legacy of British Slave Ownership. UCL aims to document the identity of every slave owner in Britain at the time of abolition. Professor Catherine Hall, who heads up the project, says that Britain's role in slavery is in need of a fresh perspective.
Instead of saying, on the one hand, you know, oh, slavery wasn't significant at all to London's history, or on the other hand, saying, you know, the whole of British capitalist society is built on slavery, we want to say, what part did it play? It certainly played an important part, but what part?
Research for the database has already turned up some interesting connections. Documents kept at the National Archives in Kew have uncovered previously unknown links between N.M. Rothschild, of the famous banking family, and James William Freshfield, founder of Freshfields, the city law firm. The Rothschild family's chief archivist was surprised at the news, as the information was neither in the family's extensive archive nor in the two-volume history written on the family. Both Rothschilds and Freshfields were quick to point to the reformist elements of their predecessors' lives. Those behind the project think that shedding light on the past can only be a good thing.
I mean, I think we'll discover uncomfortable for some people, but I think it's much better to be open about history. And I think the experience of people when they are open about it is that you can deal with it. Things that are hidden are much more troublesome on the whole than things that are openly acknowledged.
Further east from the square mile, at London's Docklands, the links between global financial houses and the slave trade are merely geographical. Here at the Museum of London, a permanent exhibition stands as testament to the wharves and warehouses along the River Thames where goods produced by slaves across the empire would make their way to the capital. But with UCL's work just getting started, we may soon know more about the past and what the implications are for the present. I'm Carol Ahoyos for the Financial Times.
Let that sink in for a minute. Why isn't that the topic of Black Talk Radio? Isn't this a worthwhile subject? I don't hear the most influential voices in black radio talking about the direct connection between the Rothschilds and slavery. Why? I mean, do we treat everything like a fad? Was the reparations movement a fad? Now, I'm not going to carry the weight. I put a blog out on this. Cover of the Financial Times, Rothschilds linked to slavery. Paper trail loosens the shackles on a hidden history. Neil Ferguson, you should be ashamed of yourself. Trying to get us to believe that in a 400-page book he wrote on the Rothschilds, he never encountered any evidence of slavery. Yet, he very lucidly writes about the obvious connection to slave trade-related industries like tobacco, cotton, and sugar that the Rothschilds helped to underwrite through public finance, public debt, bills of credit associated with tobacco, cotton, and sugar. They underwrote a loan to the government of Portugal, which was backed by revenues from sugar coming from Brazil tied to slave labor. So, please, this is no surprise. July 15th, 2009, Cedric Muhammad Black Coffee Program, 707 in Johannesburg, 710 rather, Johannesburg, South Africa. Welcome to you all, Kingston, Jamaica, 1210 p.m. Lagos, Nigeria, it's 610 p.m. Peace to you all, London, England, 610 p.m. Toronto, 110 p.m. Nairobi, Kenya, 810 p.m. Let me put the camera on me so I can show my solidarity with the people of East Africa who are not feeling Barack Obama right now. Now, I'm getting emails, phone calls, and text messages from my newfound friends, my family in Africa. Yes, get the hat. And one person told me they thought that Barack Obama's speech was boring. They said the dude is boring. That was the quote. some people feel actually insulted that he didn't come. But was it just a high-level chess move? Being that President Obama, I believe, as a senator, had already gone to Kenya, it wasn't as if he's never gone to the country. Did he make a misstep with this one? Could he have not gone to Kenya? Now, if you pass through Italy, if you pass through Rome, you're going to see the Pope. When I flew to Kenya, we went through Italy. We stopped in Rome and then went to Addis in Ethiopia and then to Kenya. It's not that far of a trip, especially on Air Force One. Well, here's what they're saying. Here's the reaction from East Africa.
But in Kenya right now, there's focusing on the, well, they're focusing on the U.S. President.
This was before the trip.
Obama. The thing is, he will be visiting the West African country of Ghana. It's his first trip to sub-Saharan Africa since he took office, but his choice of Ghana is not going down well with people in Kenya. Yvonne Ndege will explain.
A continent waits. The first African-American U.S. president is making a state visit to the land of his forefathers. It's a supremely significant moment. But the honor is going to Ghana in West Africa, not Kenya, where Obama's father was born and raised. And Kenyans are wondering why. Millions of people across Africa celebrated Obama winning the White House. Many are eager for what they see as the U.S. president's homecoming.
Here in Western Kenya, opinion is divided about President Obama's decision not to come to Kenya on his first trip to sub-Saharan Africa.
We are very disappointed. Very, very disappointed. Because it's our blood, our brother, and we can't get a chance to see him here in Kenya.
As a Kenyan citizen, I'm feeling very pain because he was not supposed to pass to Ghana before coming to Kenya.
President Obama's step-grandmother believes people have no reason to be upset.
These people are annoyed without reasons. The Americans and Ghanaians supported Barack, not Kenyans. And it's the Americans who voted for him. If the Americans say Barack must go to a certain country, he must go. I can't tell him what to do.
The failure to deal with the root causes of Kenya's 2007 post-election violence, tribalism, poverty, land issues and human rights abuses, for which more than 1,500 people died, are being talked of as the reasons why the US president is snubbing Kenya on this trip. The coalition government deal, brokered by former UN chief Kofi Annan, is shaky. High-ranking MPs and politicians accused of organizing the violence have not been brought to justice, though the Kenyan government has committed to forming a local tribunal to try suspects by the end of 2010 or face the International Criminal Court in The Hague. In going to Ghana first, some say Obama is expressing his unhappiness at the slow pace of democratic and social reform following the post-election mayhem.
The president is going to Ghana to demonstrate his support for democracy in that country and his support for democracy and democratic governance around all of Africa.
But given Obama's recent visit to Egypt, many Kenyans feel that the U.S. president can't use the lack of reforms as a reason for not coming to Kenya, given the fact that Egypt has one of Africa's most repressive and undemocratic political systems. A question I put to the U.S. president's Africa chief.
Egypt is a part of the Middle East Bureau, and I didn't come to talk about Egypt today.
Many say President Obama is not coming to Kenya this time around because the country where his father was born is just not important enough to America's current strategic interests in Africa. Yvonne Ndege, Al Jazeera, Kisumu.
Now that was from Al Jazeera. Yes, it's official. I get Al Jazeera in D.C. Those of you in D.C., you can get Al Jazeera. I don't know what happened, whether they worked out that beef or not. Now, let me get some more commentary on President Obama's trip. There's an article I want to read from The Washington Post that I thought kept it kind of real. You know what? Let me read that first. Washington Times, rather, July 9th, 2009. Peaceful vote draws Obama. One observer sees ulterior motive to visit West African nation in new discovery of oil. Now, you all, we talked about this before on the show. 2010, an enormous amount of oil comes online in Ghana. John P. Crudy writes, President Obama flies to Ghana Friday in his first presidential visit to sub-Saharan Africa, where he is expected to praise the country's electoral successes and economic development, holding it up as a model for other countries on the continent. But Africa watchers say Mr. Obama also is likely to use the visit to announce plans to strengthen security and commercial ties with the small but growing African nation. The official word is that we're celebrating democracy, but there are probably some ulterior motives, said Gerald Lamel, executive director of Africa Action, a human rights organization in Washington. It has not gone unnoticed that oil was discovered and Ghana has 600 million barrels under it and offshore. And many Ghanaian leaders think the United States might like Ghana to serve as a kind of capital for AFRICOM, the U.S. military command responsible for African operations, he said. Ambassador Amina Saloum Ali of the African Union mission in Washington said the visit is important for the volatile region. The visit is very significant for the whole of West Africa since it is a scene of instability, Ms. Ali said. Ghana has allowed democracy to mature and they have a social network that allows a lot of peaceful dialogue to take place. Ghana sits on the eastern Atlantic Ocean on the southern side of Africa's western hump. The tropical nation of low plains and plateaus is home to 23 million people, mostly Christian and of various ethnic groups. About 55% of Ghanaians work in agriculture and many work in gold and cocoa production. The government is steadily privatizing state-owned industries and production of petroleum products, discovered in 2007, will skyrocket within a decade. But right now, 30% of Ghanaians live on less than $1.25 a day, below the United Nations poverty line. Economic development was an important issue in Ghana's presidential elections in December, when John Adam Mills defeated Nana Akufo-Addo, the then ruling party's chosen successor to outgoing President John Kufuor. The election outcome was decided by less than 1% of the vote in a runoff. The ensuing transfer of power was peaceful, displaying the increasing success of democracy in a country and continent known for racial and partisan strife accompanying elections. Experts say the transition is the primary reason for Mr. Obama's visit. Oil, baby. That's all I'm going to say. Oil, 2010. A lot of oil coming online from Ghana. To all my beautiful East Africans, that's why you didn't see your native son. Now, here's what I thought of the speech. Let me let you look at me. There was a reason why this speech didn't resonate as the others had. I watched the speech. First of all, the timing of it was difficult. I was text messaging people, waking them up. The thing was on like, what, 8 a.m., 9 a.m., Saturday morning? But I think this speech was one of the few instances where it's been transparent that President Obama represents an established policy. Or I should say, this is one of the few instances where President Obama's duty to uphold established policy overwhelmed his usual ability to make nuances and show a cultural sensibility and a little bit of candor and honesty that you would not normally get in a speech. His speech on race and his speech to the Muslim world dwarfed his speech on Africa in terms of those other categories. His ability to apply nuance, speak some harsh truths, etc. That's why the president's speech got rave reviews from a lot of conservative voices, people who have a view of Africa that the leaders are corrupt and that until that problem changes, nothing else matters. Until everything is privatized, nothing else matters. You have a lot of people in Washington who hold on to that view. They applauded the speech. Some people in Africa thought it was a little paternalistic. See, I think President Obama is fun to watch, entertaining and powerful until he gets to your particular subject matter. Then you start to see, hey, you know what? He actually represents the United States of America and policy that's shaped by people that we never see. And I think that may be some of the disappointment with President Obama's speech. It didn't rise to the level of expectations because he was in the straitjacket of policy. Maybe you thought it was a great speech. I thought it was C. I gave it a C. I think he got an A for both of his speeches on race and his speech to the Muslim world. This speech, I don't know who wrote it, but his usual ability to nuance and appear as a truth teller was compromised by the need to get across some other agendas. Oil baby, 2010. Let's talk about that. The economy is even worse than you think. We just spent a good amount of time on affairs of the heart, domestic matters, folks staying married longer than they want to because of the financial realities. Oh, by the way, Ann Dayano is on the check-in. She says, Cedric, I can't make a comment, but you don't have to ask me twice about what you should do. Model them for us. Ann wants me to put on the skinny jeans on air today. Let me get back. Let me focus again. Can you imagine me? Hold on. These are the skinny jeans. All you need to see is the pant leg. I mean, my arm could barely get into that. Comment. Look at the tight jeans. Should I put these on? Go tell a friend. Maybe I should do that. Maybe hour number 5, I put the skinny jeans on. Morton Zuckerman writes, the recent unemployment numbers have undermined confidence that we might be nearing the bottom of the recession. What we can see on the surface is disconcerting enough, but the inside numbers are just as bad. I told all of you that this was going to happen. Somebody's about to lose their job before the year is out. There will be a new economic team in place. The Bureau of Labor Statistics preliminary estimate for job losses for June is 467,000, which means 7.2 million people have lost their jobs since the start of the recession. The cumulative job losses over the last 6 months have been greater than for any other period or half year period since World War II, including the military demobilization after the war. The job losses are also now equal to the net job gains over the previous 9 years, making this the only recession since the Great Depression to wipe out all job growth from previous expansion. Let me take you around the United States of America, show you how life is getting very complicated. Michigan, this is June 26, 2009. Michigan braces for a surge in welfare applications. Michigan's generous jobless benefits and strict eligibility rules have kept the welfare rolls down despite the state's 14.1% unemployment rate, the highest in the country. But a surge in jobless workers reaching the time limit for unemployment benefits in coming months could change that. A major test for the state's welfare system could come by January when nearly 1 in 7 unemployed workers will have exhausted their jobless benefits unless the laws change. Many of the more than 680,000 unemployed workers in the state are collecting jobless benefits, which last for as long as 79 weeks. Other states with high unemployment, such as Florida and Oregon, have already seen significant increases in welfare caseloads. We're expecting a huge influx of applications in the next few months, said Barbara Anders, the director of Adult and Family Services at the Michigan Department of Human Services. About 100,000 people's jobless benefits will expire by January. Officials hope for funding to add staff to handle the influx, and the state Senate Appropriations Committee has approved hiring 200 more staffers. Next story. Detroit's food bank strained to serve middle class. Battered by massive layoffs, home foreclosures, and nearly a decade of economic decline, more residents of Detroit's middle class suburbs are having a tough time putting food on the table. State agencies and nonprofit groups that serve the poor in Southeast Michigan say they are seeing an unprecedented rise in demand for food assistance across the region. They point to a pronounced increase in those seeking aid for the first time, often families unaccustomed to depending on food aid programs, and they expect the numbers to grow as Michigan's jobs picture worsens. Let me take it to the dirty, dirty. New York Times, Sunday, June 21st, 2009. Atlanta is making way for new public housing. Critics worry about the toll on residents. In 1936, Atlanta built Techwood Homes, the nation's first housing project. By the 1990s, a greater percentage of the city's residents were living in housing projects, sprawling red brick barracks that pockmarked the skyline, than in any other city in America. Now Atlanta is nearing a very different record, becoming the first major city to knock them all down. By next June, officials here plan to demolish the city's last remaining housing project, fulfilling a long and divisive campaign to reduce poverty by decentralizing it. Mixed income developments oriented toward families with trendy shops, golf courses, and YMCAs are emerging where bleak, uniform towers once stood. Displaced residents are receiving vouchers to move to private housing, and a landmark experiment in housing an urban poor in large government-run facilities that began under the New Deal is being undone. Over the past 15 years, Atlanta has bulldozed about 15,000 units spread across 32 housing projects, some of which once contained as many as 2,500 residents. That's the ATL. Let's go to PHILLY, Northwest, Southwest, Southside. City neighborhoods dig in to protect fragile gains. July 14, 2009, Wall Street Journal. This year, Margaret Shepherd is knocking on the front door of nearly every house in West Oak Lane. And hold on, let me speak to this. When I came to Jersey in the early 80s, I kept hearing everybody doing shout outs to West Oak Lane. Let me take a drink on this. Yes, I thought West Oak Lane was a street. I thought West Oak Lane had to have been the longest street in America, because everybody on the radio was shouting out their cousin in West Oak Lane. I said, damn, this is the longest street I've ever heard of. Everybody lives on West Oak Lane in Philly. Back to the story. This year, Margaret Shepherd is knocking on the front door of nearly every house in West Oak Lane. Her daily rounds are part of a large-scale effort to stem foreclosures in this blue-collar, largely African-American neighborhood. I'm getting so much exercise, it's ridiculous, Ms. Shepherd said on a recent afternoon. West Oak Lane has the kind of yo-yo economic history that marks many urban areas. The 80-year-old neighborhood had been on an upswing thanks to the efforts of local community groups, rising real estate prices, and years of easy credit that poured money into local businesses. But unemployment and foreclosures risk wiping out two decades of progress. Now the old gaunts. What's that? Oh, I forget how to say that anyway. Anyway, this Revitalization Corp, funded through a combination of real estate revenue and grants, is looking to buy foreclosed homes to keep them occupied and value stable. Instead of waiting for owners to come to them, the group brought Ms. Shepherd in to go block by block in search of stressed homeowners. Foreclosures and unemployment are wreaking havoc in communities rich and poor, but these problems can have more severe effects in transitional urban areas just starting to come back, spurring efforts to prevent a new slide. Boston Community Capital, a nonprofit that finances real estate in lower income communities across Massachusetts, is buying foreclosed homes from banks and selling them back to homeowners at lower prices and under new mortgage terms. The goal here is trying to stabilize neighborhoods by trying to keep homes occupied and productive. Now, I'm about to do a lesson in Black Electorate Economic University called the capital to labor ratio. Homeownership is important. I think the dependency on it was a little extreme. But the ability of neighborhoods like West Oak Lane that are in every city in America to bounce back in ways that properly use home ownership and real estate as a vehicle for wealth creation is going to be critical. Now, my view is that the emphasis really needs to be on entrepreneurship right now, not as much on housing. But a great story of individuals that understand what needs to be done in the new economy and in these hard times. Newark, New Jersey. Black Wall Street. I'm going to talk about the brothers who were involved with this. This was on the nightly news about 2 weeks ago. Article today in the Newark Star-Ledger on the front of blackelectric.com. Let's listen up.
Now to our Friday Making a Difference report and the story of some New Jersey businessmen who believe to repair a broken city, you have to mend the fabric that holds it together, its neighborhoods. NBC's Ron Allen now with a grassroots urban renewal effort that's making a difference in Newark.
It's a rainy Saturday morning, yet these volunteers push on, cleaning up South 9th Street, Newark, New Jersey, trying to transform at least one block ravaged by crime, abandoned buildings, and neglect.
Just trying to help clean up the, you know, the community and the residence area that has just been left for nothing.
Leading the effort, Jeff Montgomery and friends Victor Baker and Hassan Keith, who see opportunity where most only see blight.
This is the master bedroom.
Correct.
They're entrepreneurs building five brand new two-family homes where vacant lots once stood. Affordable homes marketed to police, nurses, teachers, residents who are the city's lifeblood.
I know what people perceive Newark as outside of the city, but at the same time, if we don't come back and try to make a contribution, then it will never change.
This is my hometown. I come from a neighborhood that was once a community where people were involved.
Keith brought the team together, friends since college, 20 years ago, now running their own company.
Since the beginning of time, our relationship has been, you know, one of respect, admiration, and love. It has taken them 3 years to get this far. Most of that time spent fighting through government bureaucracy and red tape for permits, approvals, and funding. Now they expect families to be living in these homes sometime this fall.
A nonprofit helps families with down payments.
This is mulch.
And teaches school students about caring for their community and more.
They really need to see the inspiration. They need to see young African-American men in charge of a restoration. They need to feel like, you know, things can get better.
Is five houses going to be enough for you?
No.
No, this is just a start.
We want this to be a start.
Yeah, this is just a start for us.
It was raining harder when I hit.
Later that morning, they planted a garden in front of a burned-out house.
It's not about the money. It's about cleaning up and getting things done.
On a street in Tough City, where these partners are determined to build more beautiful new homes. Ron Allen, NBC News, Newark, New Jersey.
Great story. I want to read an article from the Newark Star-Ledger. Now, I know two of the three. I'm not quite sure if I know the other brother because the name wasn't familiar, but I know Hassan and Victor. We were very, very friendly at Rutgers University, RU. Very proud of them. The Rutgers Network circulated this story like no other group. By the way, that's why Imus went down. I keep trying to explain this. If Imus had said what he said about black women that maybe went to a southern school, he would never have been he really was the beneficiary of whacktivism. I don't have enough time to get into that, but the sincere activists that thought they were doing something were able to get Imus out of his job because of the strength of the Rutgers Network. It's a Philly, Jersey / New York black conscious Wall Street connected kind of group. It's got a lot of juice. So Vic and Hassan, congratulations to them. And by the way, Vic's waves were always on point. And the NBC Nightly News report, it's on Black Fan, and you'll see Vic's waves are in perfect condition 10 years later. A new Black Wall Street rises in the decades after Newark's riots. This is from the editorial page of the Star Ledger. Some people call it the Star Liar. Yesterday, at a time when good economic news is scarce, it's encouraging to hear about three businessmen, all Rutgers alumni, staking a claim in the future in Newark's West Ward. Victor Baker, Hassan Keith, and Jeffrey Montgomery are constructing houses on five empty lots on South 9th Street between 11th and 12th Avenues. The Star Ledger's James Quilly described how the trio plans to serve working families in need of affordable housing with five duplex-style homes. They call the $2 million project Black Wall Street after the prosperous black community of Greenwood that thrived in Tulsa, Oklahoma in the early 20th century. It's a nickname freighted with historical significance. Greenwood was indeed a community with enormous wealth for its time and place. There, the black middle class supported a vibrant business district apart from the white city of Tulsa, which restricted black activity and even imposed curfews, not unusual in many segregated American cities of that time. The journalist Brent Staples and other historians describe Greenwood as a black city within a city of as many as 15,000 residents, boasting 191 businesses, including 15 doctors, 2 dentists, 1 chiropractor, and 3 law offices. In that sense, Black Wall Street connotes hard work, self-sufficiency, and success, but that's not the whole story. In 1921, Greenwood was destroyed, its 35 blocks consumed by fire and looting, its residents attacked and killed by the dozens by white Tulsans. The causes were varied but converged and accelerated over 3 days. The rumor that a black man had assaulted a white woman, the accumulated resentment of white Tulsa toward prosperous Black Wall Street, a vigilante mob egged on by the local newspaper and an out-of-control National Guard. Rumors, riots, looting, fires, destruction, the National Guard, these words all resonate in Newark's modern history. But there are no perfect parallels between Greenwood 1921 and Newark 1967. Newark's wealth, Newark, New Jersey, Newark's wealth, black and white, fled to the suburbs well before the civil disturbances that took place 42 years ago this week. Cities across the country were in decline, and Newark was no exception. The black community left behind struggled economically with substandard schools, low-paying jobs, and little say in decisions affecting its members' lives. A panel appointed by the governor to look into the causes of the riot issued its report for action in 1968. Its recommendations still apply today, and the city's schools, housing, and crime remain areas of concern. Greenwood rebuilt soon after the 1921 riots. One Oklahoma paper reported that by 1942, the Negro City Directory listed 242 black-owned businesses in Tulsa, mostly in Greenwood. But both black and white submerged the memory of the 1921 upheaval for decades. A report by the Tulsa Race Riot Commission was finally issued in 2001. 80 years after the fact, and in the interim, with the end of official segregation, blacks were able to live elsewhere, and Greenwood and Tulsa were affected by the same trends of urban decline and renewal affecting other cities. Last year, the Tulsa World newspaper trumpeted the construction of a downtown baseball stadium in Greenwood that would be convenient to light rail. For both Greenwood and Newark, rebuilding has had many stops and starts along the way, Renaissance and revival invoked at various times, but it's been more of a journey of incremental steps, not leaps and bounds. Still, it's only fitting that Newark would have its own Black Wall Street, a name that evokes not just prosperity, but resilience and persistence. So again, congratulations to some very good brothers, Victor Baker, Hassan Keith, and Jeffrey Montgomery, getting the kind of coverage I like to see. NBC Nightly News, Newark Star Ledger editorials. Congratulations. They're on the cover, front page of blackelectorate.com if you want to learn more. Yeah. It's over for General Hospital. It's all about Jacob's Cross. I have a lot to say about this. My transition from Dallas to General Hospital viewing. Some backsliding, some ups and downs, some inconsistency. But I think I found a winner. If you're a Jacob's Cross viewer, let me know. If you want to learn more about this Pan-African soap opera, I'm going to lay it out for you in a minute. What do you think about Black Wall Street? Skinny jeans. Tiger Woods' response to Jim Brown. I'm going to comment on the discrimination against the black children at the private swim club. You may not like what I have to say. Things have not changed as much as folks say, but what does that mean? Doesn't that suggest that the approach that we've taken is ineffective? Maybe something more than civil rights is needed? If you just heard me read that editorial, you heard the number of black-owned businesses in Tulsa. Enormous. How many do they have now? Throw them skinny jeans away. Got folks tuning in all over the world on the iPhone. I'll break that down for you next week a little bit more on how you can do that. You can get mobile with this show. Raise the flag right now. I need some soldiers to stand up. Death to the skinny jeans movement. I will bag and sag until I die. This is our leader, the man who has held the flame for slacking your jeans. If you want room, holla at Hov.
Only rapper to rewrite history without a pen. No ID on the track, let the story begin. Begin. This is anti-auto-tune, death for the ringtone. This ain't for iTunes, this ain't for sing-alongs. This is Sinatra at the opera, bring a blonde. Preferably with a fat ass who can sing a song. Wrong, this ain't politically correct. This might offend my political connects. My raps don't have melodies.
This is what I'm talking about. Jigga. Thank you, brother. The Great Depression. Thank you, Hov. Our leader, Skinny Jeans, died. Glenn from Philly is laughing because he was born in West Oak Lane, 78th and Argonne. I don't know how to say it. It's not how I'm saying it wrong. Let me read these comments. Tiger Woods, you all have some interesting thoughts. Cameron from Patterson, New Jersey says, Tiger Woods' mistake is that he's pretending that doing as little as he can is going to create social change. The problem with Tiger's answer is it's a generic quote you often hear from whites toward blacks who criticize them. He's saying, I don't know what Jim Brown's talking about, but I've done my job. We don't see the world the same way. I think Jim has a closed mind. Whatever, man. Glenn from Philly says he is attributing partial blame to Jimmy Jones for bringing skinny jeans to hip hop. Yup. Jim Jones is one of the culprits. Have seen Jim Jones with skinny jeans on. Cameron said, I do have to say I have noticed Jamaicans wearing skinny jeans long before it caught on. Although they adopted them early, I still don't believe it blew up because of them. The move to make rappers into hipsters inspired the fans to adopt this look. This generation wants its own style so badly they'll take this. Said, have you seen the New Boys, rappers from L.A.? They are into this scene heavy. No, I'm not up on the New Boys. Roginyar, Culver City, California, says, I am amazed that with all of the time that brother president spends to make sure of his next move, verbal and physical, etc., he would have taken the time to get better. Much better at throwing a baseball from the pitcher's mound. It's been done worse for sure, Carl Lewis. But Obama throws like a rank little leaguer at best. Did you notice how he strained to make or take aim during the pitch instead of throwing it with authority? He's got serious Rolls-Royce syndrome, where he's got to execute things perfectly. Ironic, given that he didn't take the time to practice throwing a stupid baseball before he got in front of millions. Well, give Obama credit. He had the windup. He was rocking and firing. That's what we used to say to the pitchers, rock and fire. So Obama was rocking, but he just didn't fire. Killer Cam from Patterson, New Jersey. Cameron says, I guess the facts tell the story. President Obama's father is one reason to go to Kenya, and Ghana had 600 million reasons for Obama to go there. I like your straight jacket of policy phrase in reference to Obama. Yeah, that speech was not what it could have been. Wrapped in the straitjacket of U.S. foreign policy interests. Send in your comments. There's a rumor that I might put on tight jeans. Skinny jeans, hour number 5, unconfirmed. Let me take this time now. Handle some serious business. Those of you that know me, you know, this is a touchy subject with me. There's only one actress out there that can make me a little nervous. So let me clear my throat. Make sure my hands are not shaking. Put her image up. That's right, y'all. Kent King, General Hospital, Kent. We have to talk. We have to talk. Let me loop the applause for Kent. If you haven't seen her, that's Kent. Give you a little more depth with the photo. Oh, hell, some more applause. One more time, loop it. I have waited for 2 years for General Hospital, dear Kent, to get it together. I see you out there in Hollywood. You're directing films. You're producing great works, winning awards for your productions. No, I'm applauding her work, not the picture. Hold on, let me put some proper bed music on. Let me put the proper bed on for Kent. So I've been waiting 2 years for General Hospital to get the act together. They continue to play with your character, Dr. Lainey Winters, and I can't take it anymore. Been together for about 2.5 years. I saw you get some burn on the NBC Night series or SoapNet Night Shift. I don't know. I've heard from my sources in Cali that you've been promoting some makeup products, coming to events, doing a wonderful job of advocating wonderful causes like fighting HIV and AIDS. But I'm torn. I don't know what to do. I cannot continue to watch GH waiting for you to appear. So I want to pledge my loyalty to you. Let me pledge my loyalty to you, Kent. But I have to move on. I support all of your causes, your works, your endeavors. Well, you got to take our relationship to another level if it's going to continue. Because damn it, at 4 o'clock, I'm watching Wendy Williams. How about that Wendy Williams program, y'all? 3 shows. I've watched 2. So this is a farewell dedication to Kent King. I'm leaving General Hospital for Jacob's Cross. Let me serenade you. Correct me if I'm wrong. If you've seen General Hospital putting her in a featured spot, it's news to me. All I see is Jason Morgan, Sonny Corinthos, and that damn Nicholas Cassidy.
Ending whackness in the name of blackness. You are listening to the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Show only at blackcoffeechannel.com.
So today, July 15, 2009, let it be known, I'm pledging my loyalty to Kent King, but it will have to be outside of the auspices of General Hospital. They don't deserve either one of us. No more Spinelli. No more Maxie Jones. No more Jax, Jasper Jax. One-to-one, cause-oriented marketing, or feature films is how we'll get down. Shoulder, feel never tired. We'll take it higher and higher.
Blackness in the name of blackness. You are listening to the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Show only at blackcoffeechannel.com. Cedric Muhammad on the Black Coffee Channel.
Lab report shows abnormally high levels of radionuclides, like radio cesium.
What does that mean?
It means there's radiation in the water.
Radiation? That's impossible.
Fortunately not. The bioaccumulation of radioactivity in the fish is significantly above guideline levels for consumption.
But where did the radiation come from?
It seems that something was buried in the ground, and it has now seeped into the water.
This is bad. This is really bad.
Sir, we have orders to escort you off the compound.
What?
He's a threat to the family, Miss Folake.
That's impossible.
If you do not leave immediately, we'd have to use force.
It's okay, Folake. I'll go.
This is the good part. They escort him off the property. Jacob's Cross.
Mama.
Shh. Chief Bola, I think, being poisoned
it's
by tea.
A dream.
She's giving him some poisonous tea.
I'm sorry. Forgive me. They want to kill me.
There, you're safe. I'm here to take care of things. You don't have to worry about anything anymore.
Tea. Drink the tea.
Just have some tea.
She's getting him.
It'll make everything better. That's it. Lovely tea.
Oh man, he drank the tea. That was Jacob's Cross, the hottest soap opera. If you're trying to, you know, wean yourself off of All My Children, One Life to Live, General Hospital, is Guiding Light still on? You know, things like that. Jacob's Cross, the Africa Channel, weeknights, 9 p.m. Let me tell you what it's all about. Show summary here, right? Jacob's Cross. It's a South African television drama series made by Mnet Original Productions. It's about powerful oil magnates battling for Africa's rich offshore oil resources. Set in both South Africa and Namibia, the story centers around businessman Jacob Makubu and his quest to build the next great South African empire. The series originally premiered in South Africa on Thursday, January 25th, 2007. It premiered on SABC 2 on Thursday, April 2nd, 2009. Now, if you all have Time Warner Cable, I believe you have the Africa Channel, same with Comcast. Now, here's the synopsis of Season 1. Jacob's Cross is a South African drama series about powerful oil magnates battling for South Africa's rich offshore oil resources. People in Jacob's world are all driven by a shared history of colonization and a desire to tap into the wealth of Africa, while being divided by feuds over who the rightful owners of the resources are, how they should be exploited, and who should benefit. The story begins when Jacob, who's living a prosperous and happy life in South Africa, gets offered a deal with immeasurable backing from a large Nigerian firm. Determined to realize his dream of accessing a new energy source, the deal offers him the perfect opportunity of making it happen. He's adamantly warned by his mother to stay away from the Nigerian dynasty and its business, but refuses to take her advice and soon finds himself in a negotiation that will change his life forever. I was not going to interrupt my serenading of Kent King of General Hospital, even for an hourly intro. I had to let mint condition finish the job. We're headed into hour number three, or two, is it two? 12, 1, 1, 2, 2, 3. Hour number three, Johannesburg, Toronto, Kingston, London, Nairobi, Lagos. I'm here.
You are tuned in to The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel.